When the cuttings were in Lhasa, the search was still being made for the child who would be the reincarnation of the 13th Dalai Lama. They had many visits and conversations with the regent and high officials. They were banqueted and entertained at elaborate parties and outdoor fetes by the 400 of Lhasa society, and overwhelmed with presents, everything from food to Tibetan rugs. When the cuttings took to the trail again, heading for the high passes and India, they left many friends behind them in Lhasa, young and old. We certainly found ourselves at an advantage, owing to Swayam Cutting's knowledge of Tibetan travel and Tibetan customs. But with all the extremely practical advice he gave, he did make one suggestion that didn't work out as he had expected. When he made his treks to the roof of the world, the Tibetans were more interested in hard currency than in paper money. With the British Raj still ruling India, the Tibetans favored Indian rupees. Cutting had carried burlap bags of the heavy stuff across the mountains, and he urged us to do the same. So we converted about $1,000 into stacks and stacks of rupees, half rupees, toana and anina coins. Uniformed chaprassis at the bank carried those 6 burlap bags of Indian money out to the United States consulate car. Escorted by Consul General Derry, we took the bags to his home. Then, under guard, to the swarming railway station. We slept with the money on the train. At Gangtok, in Sikkim, we had 3 strong wooden cases made. Each, with its bags of coin, weighed around 60 pounds. On the trail we slept with the boxes between our beds. And by day, as we rode along commune walls, we were constantly apprehensive that our rupees would wind up at the bottom of a river. During our 24 days on the trail, it took 1.5 mules, or yaks, just to carry our hard cash, always under close guard. With much trouble and worry we lifted those boxes over the Himalayas to Lhasa with their 200 pounds of coins. But, at the Dalai Lama's capital, we were told that the Tibetans no longer wanted the stuff. Now they preferred paper money, either Indian or their own. And each time we flashed our coins they would demand a much more generous exchange rate, or would flatly refuse to touch them. It would have been far better to have taken a roll of bills in a hip pocket. We were about resigned to packing those 200 pounds of money back to India when, at the last minute, an ex-top official, the Tibetan Croesus, Zarong Shape, heard of our predicament and took the bags of coins off our hands. 3. Why we were invited? Why had we been so lucky? How had we come to be invited to the land of the Lamas? What had caused the young Dalai Lama and his advisors to comply so promptly with our request to visit Lhasa? Countless pleas for admission are sent from every corner of the globe, but they are ignored. As my father and I rounded narrow ledges along the steep canyon walls and slowly mounted the dizzy mountain passes on the ancient caravan route to the holy city, in August, 1949, we talked over these questions. No explanation had been given to us. All we knew was that, happily for us, permission had come through without delay. We suspected that the answer was one word: communism. The Tibetan officials in Lhasa later confirmed our hunch. Tibet fears communism. By the summer of 1949, the Chinese Reds had brought most of China under their control and made it clear that when the China job was finished, Tibet would be their next objective. This was the chief topic of conversation when we reached Lhasa. Acutely aware of the Reds' intentions, the Lhasa government was considering how America might be made to realize Tibet's serious problem of defense against Asiatic communism. Moreover, they wanted America and all the world to know that they are now, and have always considered themselves, an independent nation. At the psychological moment, when the top Tibetan officials were debating what would be the best way to inform America of the Red threat to Tibet, our request was forwarded from India. They decided to take a gamble and we were invited to Lhasa. So ours was the once in 3 lifetimes opportunity to travel into the heart of an incredible, fabulous, storybook country, a journey taking us out of this world. Why should this small country, whose people only want to be left alone to mind their own affairs and live in their unique culture undisturbed, why should it be threatened? And why should we, on the other side of the world, be concerned? The peril is imminent. On the north and east are innumerable victorious Chinese communist troops who have been practically idle following the rapid collapse of the nationalist government. The communist radio in China has broadcast a number of times within recent months its plans to liberate Tibet. The Tibetans may lack modern conveniences, but their government heads are intelligent and fully aware of the havoc and misery communist liberation has wrought in other small countries. At the time of our visit, only 10,000 Tibetan troops, armed with obsolete weapons, stood behind the mountain barrier to safeguard their homeland. We were told that another 100,000 were being hurriedly mobilized and armed with light weapons purchased from India, but without the most up-to-date equipment and training they might not be enough protection against fanatical communist hordes. The communists covered Tibet for several reasons. If they gain control of the holy city of Lhasa, they can wield tremendous influence over the Central and Eastern Asian Buddhist world. But the main reason is strategic, for possession of Tibet would give them an 1,800-mile frontier with India and an ideal jumping-off spot, mostly downhill, for an army to invade the vast peninsula of Hindustan and dominate its 400 million people. Tibet is all that stands between the Red Armies of China and India. And India holds the key to the domination of the whole continent of Asia. Then there is the significance of Tibet's mineral wealth. About a year ago, the British Foreign Office announced that expeditions in Tibet had discovered mineral deposits of unascertainable value. Degrees. The London Dispatch implied that this new find was radioactive metal, the material of the atomic bomb. Further evidence that the high spot of the world is fast becoming a hot spot was produced with the reports that Soviet Russia is extending a chain of air bases down through Central Asia toward Tibet and that a modern military highway is being constructed by the Chinese communists through their western provinces to the Tibetan border. Recently we had an amazing indication of Moscow's zealous interest in Tibet, when the Soviet weekly, New Times, official organ of the Kremlin, attacked us editorially. The publication charged we had been sent to Tibet by the United States government to try to tear that country away from China and turn it into an Anglo-American colony. The New Times said that my father and I had been given a very important role by the United States government for what the Russian journal labeled a dirty adventure. Dirty is a favorite Soviet adjective. Here's the latest Kremlin twister, broadcast by the Czechoslovak Red Radio and designed to pave the way for invasion. The strategic position of Tibet and its uranium ore stimulated the Washington strategists to gain influence over Tibet. A year ago, says the communist propaganda, an American expedition was sent to Tibet, headed by an agent of the OSS who modestly calls himself a radio commentator. These are the words from Red Prague. So, to the liars in the Kremlin, who falsify just about everything, my dad is not a radio commentator, but a special government agent. There are no limits to what the communists will say if they think what they say will help them gain their point. Surely a house built on such shifting sands on a fabric of lies will collapse. Not only had there been no consultation with officials in Washington previous to our journey, but in my father's haste to get off he failed to ask President Truman if he wanted to send a gift or letter to the Dalai Lama. This is a customary courtesy, a gesture that should never be neglected by anyone fortunate enough to be invited to the Forbidden City. Then, as my father's radio listeners well know, the whole affair was about as private as a fishbowl. We sent frequent recordings back to America, describing our journey into and over the Himalayas and the interviews we had with prominent Tibetans. These recordings went out both by long and short wave over a vast radio network on Dad's nightly CBS News show. So there was nothing secret or confidential about any part of our journey. Ours was decidedly not a government mission, but we had every intention of openly informing the American people of whatever we could learn about the growing crisis with which Tibet was confronted and with Tibet, the nations of the free world. Some of the most fruitful talks we had in Lhasa were with Tibet's two astute foreign ministers, a monk named Luishao Dzogchen Lama and Sakhang Dzogchen, a layman, both recognized authorities on Tibetan history. seated in their office in a building next to Lhasa's sacred cathedral known as the Jokang, we were offered an illuminating perspective of the foreign ministers, Luishao Dzaze Lama and Sakang Dzaze. Their office has the responsibility of directing the negotiations with Red China for a peaceful settlement of China's claim to Tibet as a Chinese province. Tibet's two main problems, communism and China. We asked them about rumors we had heard in India that there had been a communist revolt in Lhasa in which a number of Chinese and Tibetans had been killed. Not true, both ministers exclaimed simultaneously in vigorous Tibetan, translated by our interpreter. Their explanation of this rumor is significant, since Tibet abhors as well as fears communism, which is contrary to its whole philosophy of life, and since Tibetans are not exactly enthusiastic that they have to accept the geographical fact that Red China is their next door neighbor. But first I shall try to sum up briefly the background of Chinese-Tibetan relations, as the two ministers put it to us. Historically, geographically and culturally there have been close ties between China and Tibet for many centuries. Evidence of this abounds today. Tibetans on the eastern plateau nearest the Chinese border have adopted many Chinese customs, from chopsticks to pigtails. The Chinese have given up the pigtails, but upper-class Tibetans still wear them. Wealthy Tibetans are robed in Chinese silks and embellish their homes with Chinese furniture and porcelain. Since before America was discovered, caravans have plodded wearily over the ancient and difficult trade routes, bringing Tibetan wool to China and Chinese brick tea to Tibet. The great Tibetan monasteries are filled with priceless old Chinese treasures, the gifts of Chinese emperors. From the 7th to the 9th centuries of our era, Tibet and China were constantly at war. The Tibetans had not yet fallen under the peaceful influence of Buddhism. Then they were one of the great military powers of Asia and could give as well as take the blows. In the middle of the 7th century the Chinese captured Lhasa but, in AD 763, Tibet won an overwhelming victory over the Chinese, who had to pay a large tribute to save their capital. At that time Chang'an. Again, a few years later, Tibet overran Western China. This time the Chinese had to sign a treaty by which Lake Kokonor was fixed as the northeastern boundary of Tibet. Thus the Tibetans held fast to their beloved mountain country. What the Tibetans lost in martial spirit with the rise of Buddhism, they gained in religious influence. Kublai Khan, founder of the Mongol dynasty of China, was converted to the Lamaistic form of Buddhism by the high priest of Sakya Monastery near Lhasa, and the great Khan, with one of his granite gestures, graciously appointed the monk secular ruler of Tibet. Thus began the reign of Tibetan priest kings. In time Mongolia was completely converted to Tibetan Buddhism. It was the Mongols during the reign of Altan Khan, who first gave the monk ruler at Lhasa the title, Dalai Lama Vajradhara, which means the all-embracing Lama, the holder of the thunderbolt. The spiritual supremacy and religious authority of the Dalai Lama were accepted in China, Mongolia and many Central Asian regions, as well as in his own country. When the fifth Dalai Lama known as the Great Fifth came to Peiping in the early years of the Manchu dynasty the emperor met him a day's journey from the capital. At the imperial palace the emperor stepped down from the dragon throne and advanced to greet him, indicating that the Dalai Lama was regarded as an independent ruler, a remarkable concession in the days when Chinese emperors had it pretty much their own way, at least in China. It was, however, under the Manchus, from the 17th through the 19th century, that China tightened its control on Tibet. Chinese residents, known as Ambans, were stationed permanently in Lhasa. Tibet sent annual tribute to Peiping. It was the Chinese, we were told, not the Tibetans, who spread abroad the impression that Tibet was a forbidden country. As long as the Chinese did not interfere too much in internal affairs, this arrangement suited the Tibetans perfectly, since they did not want encroachments by other countries. As a matter of fact, as the Manchu power grew weaker, their control over Tibet slackened. China, regarding Tibet as an outer province, always had difficulty in administering its outer provinces. In the latter part of the 19th century, Tibet was practically free of any real Chinese domination, due to the efforts of the 13th Dalai Lama. In 1911, when the Sun Yat-sen Revolution forced out the Manchus to make way for the Chinese Republic, the Tibetans declared their freedom, formally ending China's suzerainty and packing the Ambans back to China. Ever since then, Tibet has been completely independent, said Sakang Zaza, tapping his red lacquer table with a bamboo pen. And Luisha, the red-robed monk, nodded enthusiastically in agreement. But the Chinese never officially recognized Tibet's declaration of independence. When the 13th Dalai Lama died in 1933, Chiang Kai-shek's government sent a mission to Lhasa to express deep sympathy. Part of this mission, equipped with a wireless sending set, stayed on, allegedly to settle boundary disputes. Tibet considered the Chinese group temporary, but the Chinese regarded it as permanent. When the present Dalai Lama was enthroned in the capital in 1940, another mission arrived from China for the ceremony. Both the Chinese envoy and the British representative were admitted to the Potala for the enthronement ceremony. Later, the Chinese press reported that the Chinese envoy, escorting the Dalai Lama to his throne, announced the installation. Then, according to the Chinese report, the little Dalai Lama prostrated himself in gratitude, implying submission. The Tibetans indignantly deny this, but unfortunately they have no news service to refute false statements or to present to the world their own version of what happens in Tibet. Most of the Chinese who came for the enthronement also stayed on in Lhasa, together with a detachment of Chinese troops. In 1945, the Tibetans urged Chiang Kai-shek to admit Tibet's autonomy officially, but the Generalissimo kept putting them off. He had always insisted that as far as foreign affairs were concerned, Tibet was an outer province of China. The Tibetans strongly disclaimed his assertion, and they gave little heed to it. At that time, it did not mean much to them, one way or the other. As a closed country, they had no problems in foreign affairs, only trade relations with India and China. Then a real threat appeared on the horizon. Civil war broke out in China. The Chinese Reds were winning. The nationalist government was losing on all sides. The Dalai Lama's advisers, fearing that when the Reds controlled all of China they would also lay plans to absorb Tibet, took steps to oust the Chinese officials who had come with the special missions to Lhasa and stayed on as permanent but unwelcome residents. The Tibetan officials figured out that the new Red regime in China would want to send its own mission to Lhasa. And Chinese communists in Tibet would increase the danger of Soviet Russia's infiltration into this most religious of Buddhist countries. The Tibetan government decided to make its position clear without delay to deny that Tibet had been even in the shadow of Chinese influence since 1911, when it announced its complete independence from China. Then, if the nationalists were driven from China by the Reds, the Tibetans could say to Mao Zedong's communist government, "We are an independent country, just as you are. We are not saying that you can't send a diplomatic envoy to Lhasa, but you can't tell us how to run our own affairs." This was also the moment, the two ministers told us, to get rid of all those suspected of being communist sympathizers. A Chinese restaurant in Lhasa, which had been spotted as an informal meeting place for agitators, was closed. The Chinese were invited to a garden party. It was all very friendly and 37, very correct. They bowed low to one another. They drank tea together. Then the Tibetans, with urbane oriental courtesy, told the Chinese that they must leave at once. The next day, 80 to 100 Chinese, with wives and children, were escorted on their way out of the country by a guard d'honor headed by a general and a ranking lama. Presents of food and money were given to the Chinese. The most delightful and characteristically Tibetan touch was the band dispatched to play continuously for the entertainment of the departing guests on the difficult 8-day trip to Yatung, not far from the Indian frontier. This all happened about a month before our arrival. So you see, concluded Sakang Zaza, far from being a communist revolt, this incident, so twisted by outside rumors, was quite the opposite. Tibet, we were given to understand, had used the expulsion of the Chinese to show the world in general and the communists in particular that it was completely independent and would brook no outside interference unless forced to submit to military conquest. That, alas, is the rub. The 13th Dalai Lama was endowed with exceptional capacities, both as a secular and as a religious ruler. 2 years before he died, or, as the Tibetans say, departed to the heavenly field, he wrote a long and remarkable letter to his people, who call it the Precious Protector's Last Testament. He seemed to have a prophetic vision of the troubles that were likely to visit his beloved country, high in the clouds. I should like to quote a passage from the translation made by Sir Charles Bell. The present is the time of the five kinds of degeneration in all countries. In the worst class is the manner of working among the red people. The reference here is to the USSR. They do not allow search to be made for the new incarnation of the Grand Lama of Urga. They have seized and taken away all the sacred objects from the monasteries. 38. They have made monks to work as soldiers. They have broken religion, so that not even the name of it remains. Have you heard of all these things that have happened at Urga? And they are still continuing. It may happen that here in the center of Tibet the religion and the secular administration may be attacked both from the outside and from the inside. Unless we can guard our own country, it will now happen that the Dalai and Panchen Lamas, the Father and the Son, the holders of the faith, the glorious rebirths, will be broken down and left without a name. As regards the monasteries and the priesthood, their land and other properties will be destroyed. The administrative customs of the three religious kings will be weakened. The officers of the state, ecclesiastical and secular, will find their jans seized and their other property confiscated, and they themselves made to serve their enemies, or wander about the country as beggars do. All beings will be sunk in great hardship and in overpowering fear. The days and the nights will drag on slowly in suffering. Do not be traitors to church and state by working for another country against your own. Tibet is happy, and in comfort now. The matter rests in your own hands. All civil and military matters should be organized with knowledge, act in harmony with each other, do not pretend that you can do what you cannot do. The improvement of the secular administration depends on your ecclesiastical and secular officials. High officials, low officials and peasants must all act in harmony to bring happiness to Tibet. One person alone cannot lift a heavy carpet, several must unite to do so. The 13th Dalai Lama seemed to understand the communist technique of boring from within as well as of invading from without. That they should work together in unity and harmony was the best advice he could offer his people as a weapon against a menace he recognized 20 years ago. He had no illusions that Tibet, alone and unaided, 39, could put up a military defense against the rising tide of communist aggression. It is a year now since our visit to Lhasa. As I write, newspaper reports of the Tibetan situation grow increasingly ominous. Some say that 800,000 Chinese communists are poised on the Sikang border ready to invade Tibet. Others claim that red troops have already moved across the Tibetan frontier. None of the rumors has been definitely corroborated as yet. However, one thing is certain. The Tibetans, who had hoped for some support from the West or from India, have become discouraged. An 8-member Tibetan delegation headed by Tsepan Shekabpa has gone to India, for the purpose of making as favorable terms as possible with Peiping, independence, if possible, if not, local autonomy. No one can predict tomorrow's move. The land of the Lamas may be the next small country on the communists' list for extinction. 44. OFF to Gangtok. When an expedition bound for Tibet leaves Calcutta, it looks like Ringling, Barnum and Bailey equals emerging from winter quarters. But against an oriental background, it is even more colorful than the circus. An army of coolies handled our cases, food, clothing, presents, camping gear, film for 6 cameras, recording equipment and 1 iron trunk filled with those heavy bags of hard currency. We left the last night of July for the railroad center of Siliguri, at the foot of the mighty Himalayas, 300 miles north of Calcutta. squeezed into the train compartment with us were a ton of supplies and Johnny Roberts of Wakefield, Massachusetts, a young photographer who had been working with me in Iran. We had special permission to take him on the first part of the journey, over the main chain of the Himalayas, to a point about 4 miles inside Tibet. We stacked our cases of food against the compartment doors and bolted the windows as a precaution against burglary. Passengers on that night train have frequently been 41 OFFT ganked or robbed, some even murdered. None of us did much sleeping as we rattled north across the plains of Bengal. Nearing Siliguri in the morning, we looked out the train window. Before us, rising above the green jungled foothills of Sikkim and set in a cold blue sky, loomed the towering snow-capped peaks of the most formidable mountain wall in the world. Dominating the range, its summit far above its neighbors, was Kinchinjunga, third highest mountain on the earth, soaring 28,146 feet above sea level. That's almost twice as high as California's Mount Whitney, our loftiest peak. Kinchinjunga, rising like a lone sentinel in all its majesty from the flat Bengal plain, is even more impressive and awe-inspiring than Everest, loftiest of all mountains, located in the midst of other high peaks farther to the west on the Tibet-Nepal border. The mountain folk have a charming legend about Kinchinjunga. They say it is the home of a spirit who, in the form of a goose, showed the way over the mountain passes to the monk who brought the message of Buddhism to Sikkim. At Siliguri we were met by a bus driver representing our transportation agent in Gangtok. He was called Lulu, and Lulu certainly lived up to his name. With the usual bickering and shouting over backsheesh, a score of Bengali in turbans and G-strings transferred our 37 boxes and pieces of luggage to Lulu's truck for the 70-mile trip to Gangtok, capital of Sikkim, where we were to organize our Tibetan caravan. Piling into Lulu's war-weary British lorry, we plunged into the jungle and snorted up a mountain road. A spectacular road it was, narrow, steep and winding. The jungle growth was thick around us and the muddy Tista, swollen with monsoon rains, howled nearby. Once a big monkey excitedly crossed the road just ahead of Lulu's truck. After several hours of slow climbing, during which we waited nervously for one of the bulging tires to blow out, we came to a small village. Here we bought several delicious 42, pineapples and bananas, our first good meal in 24 hours. A bit farther along we had to halt to show our passes at the Sikkim frontier. At the boundary line was a bridge to which were attached about 100 white prayer flags, many in tatters, on which Buddhist prayers were inscribed. It is believed that each time the flags flutter in the breeze the prayers are transmitted to the Buddhist spiritual world. At the 20-mile point in our narrow road we were stopped by an old slide. It took more than 2 hours of hard labor to carry our baggage over the obstruction and transfer it to another dilapidated lorry. On we chugged, but before we had time to wipe the sweat from our brows the brakes screeched and brought us to another abrupt halt. Lulu and the two coolies began to jabber excitedly. "It's a slip, a slip," they cried, pointing to a billowing cloud of dust rising above the jungle half a mile ahead. "How can it be?" I questioned. "Surely no landslide could raise such a cloud of dust." But we soon found out. Up ahead the road was blocked by an immense wall of rock, dirt and stripped tree trunks, a huge tongue reaching out of the jungle on our right and spilling into the Tista River on the left. One look at the boiling cloud of pulverized rock showed that the slide must have come down just before we came along. The whole side of a mountain had collapsed under the monsoon rains. A mile and a half of jungle had slipped into the Tista, and the debris filled the road to a height of 200 feet for a quarter of a mile. Natives who had been near the spot told us that the slide came down with a roar like thunder and that the swift-flowing river, powerful as its current was from the monsoon rains, was blocked off for several minutes until it built up enough pressure to sweep boulders and trees out of the way. We had no chance of getting across or around the slide that day. Fortunately, nearby was one of the many shelters 43 provided for stranded wayfarers in the mountain states on the Indian side of the Himalayas. So we thankfully took possession of the empty bungalow for the night. too stimulated by our first day on the road to turn in immediately after a makeshift supper, Johnny, Dad and Jay sat around for a while. We plunged into a discussion about that prince of travelers, Marco Polo. He covered more of Asia than any other traveler of the Middle Ages. When the famous Venetian crossed the Pamirs of Central Asia, he was not far from Tibet.